Lecture 36, The Viking Legacy.
In this lecture, I want to conclude the course on the Age of the Vikings, and there's really two objectives in this particular lecture. In part, it's something of a postscript. I want to follow up on the theme of, well, what happens to Scandinavia now that they are Christian kingdoms, they have been integrated into the wider European world. And I do believe some thoughts on the directions of future Scandinavian history are in order. Those directions are very much influenced by the Viking Age and its immediate aftermath, and will act as a way of introducing you to later Scandinavian history, particularly Scandinavia of the Reformation and the so-called Wars of Religion. The other important, and by far the larger part of this lecture, is to sum up the importance of the Viking Age for Scandinavia and for medieval civilization as a whole. And there, I think it's very important for us to look at a number of changes and themes in this course and understand how the Vikings came to play such a decisive role in the formation of Latin Christendom and eventually Western Europe. Well, let's take a look at our postscript first and just give something of an update of what the future is for Scandinavia in the aftermath of the Viking Age. I had closed the last two lectures, which dealt with the development of Christian Scandinavia up to about 1350, and I chose that date because that represents the impact of the Black Death, which raged across Europe and the Near East between 1347 and 1351, affecting areas at different times, but within a 5 or 6 year period, this great epidemic swept across most of the civilized areas of Western Eurasia and killed between 1/2 and 2/3 of the population. Deaths usually occurred within several months when the plague arrived. The attrition rates in cities were nothing short of catastrophic. Figures from the Mediterranean world suggest that a city within a matter of 2 months could lose anywhere from 75 to 80% of its population. And it had major repercussions in religious life, in economics, in political life for both Islamic and Christian civilizations. And Scandinavia was profoundly affected by it, notably Norway and Denmark. That the aftermath of the Black Death and its repercussions, along with several themes that I stressed in the last several lectures, that is the rising prosperity in Scandinavia as a result of changes after 1100, the common Viking heritage and culture that kept the Scandinavian peoples together and gave them a sense of identity even after the conversion to Christianity, and above all, the success of at least turning the three Scandinavian kingdoms into territorial Christian kingdoms of some sort, could all of these elements, along with the changes wrought in the late 14th and 15th century, have led to some kind of unification of Scandinavia into a wider political unit, and so that the Scandinavians would play a more prominent role in the later Middle Ages and early modern period? Well, that seemed to have been the case in 1397 when the three kingdoms were united. This is very often known in Scandinavian history as the Union of Kalmar, which refers to the document, and there's really two documents that worked out the unification of the three crowns, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, in the hands of a man named Erik of Pomerania, who was the great nephew of Queen Margaret of Denmark, the daughter of Valdemar IV of Denmark. And Valdemar IV and his daughter Margaret had worked assiduously for decades to bring the three crowns together. And it was assisted by the accidents of death, birth, marriage. But in 1397, all of the crowns came into the hands of Erik of Pomerania. It seemed to promise a new age for Scandinavia. In some ways, it looked like a bit of the revival of the Empire of Canute, minus England. Furthermore, it promised a unification of royal power. To be sure, the provisions as enforced in Sweden had to go through the royal council, but it did seem to promise that an effective Scandinavian monarchy could curb the power of the Hanseatic League, which had come to dominate banking and shipping. Could also turn Scandinavia into a great monarchy that could compete with the monarchies emerging in the late medieval period, notably England, France, the monarchy of Poland, which at this point is quite significant, the great principalities of Germany. The destinies were more in the principalities rather than the Holy Roman Empire, but these great principalities such as Saxony or the future Austria, Bavaria, they were powerful states indeed. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way, and there were two reasons for it. One, the Union of Kalmar, as far as I can see, in many ways was more of a union brought about by weakness and hopes rather than any real strength. And from the start, Eric of Pomerania, who had his own problems and was hardly diplomatic, from the start, the Swedes dictated the conditions in Stockholm. The Danish king never really ruled in Sweden and through Sweden, the Finnish possessions of Sweden, except with the will of the council. And through the whole period of this union in the 15th century, in the early 16th century, leading up to the famous Stockholm massacre and the renunciation of Danish rule, the Swedes essentially got what they wanted out of this union and really restricted royal rights in Sweden. They were assisted by the fact that Eric and several of the later Danish kings really played into their hands by favoring Danish appointments over Swedish appointments. They gave a lot of cause for the Swedes not to cooperate with the Danish crown. But the union also revealed several other important aspects of how Scandinavian society had evolved. Danes, Norwegians, and Swedes had evolved into different people. Their vernaculars were now distinct enough that they had independent literatures. They were no longer speakers of a common Danish tongue. In mores and aesthetics, the Danes in many ways resembled their German neighbors immediately to the south, and it would be very difficult to distinguish a German burgher from a Danish burgher in the year 1400. And Denmark was particularly receptive to the Reformation because it was so closely tied to the North German towns and principalities where the Reformation took off in the 16th century. Norway, ironically, came under Danish control as a province, but was treated as an outland province and not very important. And the reason for that were really the economic implications of the Black Death. Both Norway and Denmark were hit very hard demographically by the Black Death in the mid-14th century, but Denmark recovered rather rapidly. Immigration of Germans helped replenish the population, but furthermore, the economic consequences of the Black Death favored more. It's difficult to say luxury goods, but if you dealt in bulk commodities, if you handled grains or basic foodstuffs, prices crashed immediately in the Black Death because the market collapsed. You didn't have the same number of people to feed. And if your economy very much depended on that, you were in trouble, and that was true with Norway. There wasn't the demand for cod the way there had been before. On the other hand, if you were engaged in prestige items, especially if you're dealing, as Denmark did, in dairy and beef and pork products, those were always a small part of the diet. Well, now the survivors of the Black Death, and economics historians generally agree, those few who survived actually did pretty well. This wasn't really prosperity, but if you kill two-thirds of the population, everyone, you know, just by the laws of arithmetic, are wealthier, so they had more money to spend, and therefore Denmark marketed the type of commodities that allowed the Danish economy to bounce back much more readily. And ironically, Norway came to depend on imported Danish foodstuffs. And essentially, Norway was integrated into the Danish kingdom because its population had been so badly disrupted by the Black Death. The population, there weren't really sufficient number of bishops and men of property to carry on royal institutions so that the Danish crown under the Union of Kalmar could appoint Danish officials, or often German officials, to run Norway, turn Norway into a Danish province, and furthermore, Norway was increasingly dependent on Danish foodstuffs and goods, and so Norway passed under Danish control and would remain so down to 1815 when it was turned over to Sweden at the Congress of Vienna. To me, there's a certain depressing aspect in all of this. And in reviewing Viking history and the achievements of Harald Finehair and the splendid isolation of Jarl Hakon the Great, who defied the Danes and the Jomsvikings, Vikings, St. Olaf in his great victory, Magnus the Great, the son of St. Olaf, and of course Harald Hardrada, to think that Norway was able to beat back Danish attack after Danish attack in the Viking Age only to succumb to Denmark because of the black rats that carried the Black Death is truly an ignominious way for this great monarchy to end, but that's essentially what happened. Sweden was affected the least. by the demographic and economic implications of the Black Death, and Sweden did quite well in the 14th and 15th centuries, and the Royal Council was able to assert itself and eventually to shake off Danish rule. And so what happened out of the Union of Kalmar was the reconfiguration of two kingdoms, Norway-Denmark under the Oldenburg dynasty, and eventually Sweden-Finland under the Vasa house, both of them hereditary monarchies that would vastly expand their powers in the Reformation by the confiscation of church properties, the taking over and establishment of national churches. And those two monarchies represented quite separate identities, national identities, and the kings of Denmark and the kings of Sweden would then struggle for mastery of the Baltic, and in the end, Moscow would win. Well, with that postscript, essentially Denmark and Sweden fought themselves to a standstill, and ultimately it was the Russia of Peter the Great that came to dominate the Baltic. Well, in the course of looking at Scandinavian history and concluding in this late Middle Ages, I think it's important to review what we've achieved in this course. The course is more ambitious than the title implies. We're not looking just at the Viking Age. We've looked at also the evolution of Scandinavia both before the Viking Age and in the centuries immediately after. And that has caused us to take a wider perspective on the subject. And I think that's all important in understanding the decisive role that Scandinavians in the Viking Age played. Even in the Reformation, in the age of the War of Religions, Scandinavians never played the premier role the way they did in that period from 790 to about 1100. And this has caused us to start this course looking in the first third of the lectures at the origins of Scandinavian history. We've shown how there is a very long tradition of Scandinavia being influenced by Western and Central Europe, the ability to assimilate technological and cultural innovations to a Scandinavian landscape. We started off with that in the Bronze Age, where the adoption of farming, stock raising, bronze tools, metallurgy, led to the birth of the first significant Scandinavian cultural period, the so-called Northern Bronze Age, extending from 1550 to 1100 BC, a time when the core areas of Scandinavia were settled, where agriculture begins to be practiced, and as far as we can tell from the cultural remains, the physical remains, that the earliest definition of the Scandinavian gods took place, the Vanir, the conception of Thor. Certainly, the basic cosmology eventually expressed in the prose Edda, marvelous bronze gilt horse of the sun chariot, which seems to be indications that already in the late Bronze Age we can begin to speak of, if nothing else, proto-Scandinavians. This pattern is again repeated in the so-called Celtic and Roman Ages. Those are the periods of the Iron Age, where trade, some immigration, but particularly trade, greatly enriched material life in Scandinavia and led to important changes. It led to technological changes in shipbuilding starting certainly by 300 BC, and that outside influence set in motion the innovations and improvements in shipbuilding that eventually gave Scandinavians their longships and canards of the Viking Age. It also enriched material life. It probably had a profound influence in redefining the gods along certain Celtic patterns. The Norse gods may have acquired some of their personality we see in later literature. And in the Roman Age and in the succeeding Age of Migrations, an argument is often made that Odin emerged as the premier god of the Scandinavians, associated with the sword. Swords are a common import in the Roman Age and later. Odin becomes the quintessential war god who comes to embody the Viking Age. Furthermore, the Scandinavians gain close contacts with Western Europe, with Britain, with Gaul. There's important trade connections. And those trade connections continue in the Age of Migrations. And when those trade connections are disrupted, when the flow of goods from Western Europe are in any way impeded, well, then the Scandinavians, in part, are forced to go out and get them themselves. And that's sometimes argued as one of the motives behind the Viking Age. We also looked at the Age of Migrations, that period from 400 to 600, which in my opinion was so decisive in shaping the civilization of the Viking Age. In fact, the only real point missing in the Age of Migrations, perhaps, are the great ships that allowed the Viking Age. The sagas and legends, if we can trust in what we're getting from the poem of Beowulf and from the Icelandic sagas, already in that period of the Age of Migration, Scandinavians had that martial ethos, that cult of Odin, the tradition of the great halls associated with legendary figures as Hrolf Kraki, and the great halls, which were later the basis of the sea kings of the Viking Age and ultimately the Christian territorial kings of the late Viking Age and later. And it is also in the Age of Migrations where the Scandinavians define themselves as distinct from their Germanic kinsmen of Central Europe, of the Carolingian Empire, and in England. That saw the development of what Scandinavians called in 1100 the Danish tongue, the distinct North Germanic dialects that eventually would evolve into Icelandic, Swedish, Norwegian, and Danish. It saw the development of Scandinavian poetry. It intensified the heroic traditions and ethos. I stressed very much how the Scandinavians took the legends of their West Germanic kinsmen, the legends of their kinsmen, the Goths in Eastern Europe, recast them as quintessentially Scandinavian figures, and made them their own. And that is all occurring in this period of the Age of Migrations, which in some ways is one of the very most creative periods in early Scandinavian history, and broke the Scandinavians off into the independent civilization of the Viking Age and made them a people very different from their kinsmen in Western Europe, who were evolving into Christian Europeans and who would turn out to be their foes and victims in the Viking Age. We then expanded the perspective in this course when we got to the Viking Age proper. And we devoted close to a third of the class, or the course, to the Viking impact overseas. And this is where Scandinavians made their greatest impact in European history. And one should reflect upon how wide-ranging those influences and that impact was. The Viking trade, raids, settlements overseas wrought great changes from Ireland to Russia. In many ways, it also transformed the Scandinavian homeland, but let's put that aside for a moment. They were clearly feared by Christians and Muslims as the quintessential barbarian, the worst nightmare. And the stereotypical images that we still have of the Vikings really goes back to those images of the 9th and 10th century, the prayer that's often raised in the Carolingian world, O Lord, deliver us from the fury of the Northmen. We, of course, have added the horned helmets, inappropriately taken from the Bronze Age, to fire up that image. But the image has a historical basis. The Vikings were incredibly destructive. They were warriors who made war violently on a scale that most of their victims could really not match or even appreciate the martial ethos behind it. Nonetheless, despite all the suffering, despite all the destruction wrought by the Vikings, there were important changes. In the case of the Carolingian Empire, that great synthesis achieved by Charlemagne, which is so promising and so fundamental to European civilization, it was the Vikings, not the Muslims in Spain, not the Magyars in the east, not the Byzantines in southern Italy, but the Vikings, the Scandinavians, the least civilized opponents of the Western Europeans, who revealed the fundamental weaknesses in that Carolingian state. The Carolingian state in the 9th century failed to meet the Viking attacks. The fiscal and military weaknesses were painfully revealed by the end of the 9th century. The Carolingian dynasty was essentially bankrupt politically, eventually replaced by the Capetians. In its place, Europe broke up into smaller states, eventually the Holy Roman Empire and what is to become France. But above all, the building blocks for the new European political order were in the feudal states that made up those kingdoms, notably the great feudal states of northwestern Europe, which were the very states that would conduct the Crusades and the expansion of Western Europe in the later Middle Ages. The Vikings themselves had a hand not only in promoting these changes, but establishing what was to turn out to be the premier feudal state in the new order, and that was the Duchy of Normandy. It is inconceivable to imagine European history without Normandy and the Normans. They forged the most effective state in what was to become France. William the Conqueror conquered England, reintegrated England, and ultimately the whole British Isles back into the Carolingian political order of Western Europe. And the Norman Kingdom that was established in England is the basis for the English monarchy and English law. Without the Norman conquest, it's doubtful whether that England would have survived as a unified state, given the political situation in the later years of Edward the Confessor. The Normans went on to cross to Ireland and to intervene in Scotland and to bring the more remote areas of the British Isles into closer political and cultural union with Western Europe. They campaigned in Spain, and above all, they went into the southern sections of Italy and Sicily and founded a second Norman kingdom, the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, destined to be one of the great four monarchies of the Middle Ages. Norman England, Norman Sicily, France, and the Holy Roman Empire. Those would end up being the great monarchies of the 13th century. The Vikings dictated the course of English history. And without the Viking attacks, one wonders what would have happened in England. They determined that Wessex would emerge as the kingdom to unite England. And it was in response to the Danish attacks that one of the most brilliant kings of the early Middle Ages, Alfred the Great, forged the institutions that fought back the Vikings and allowed his descendants to incorporate the Vikings of the Danelaw into that expanded kingdom of Wessex and achieve a unity, a kingdom of England, in the reign of King Egdor. Clearly one of the great achievements of the early Middle Ages, in a period characterized by political fragmentation, that England was united under these kings. And ironically, that kingdom passed in toto to the Danish conqueror Canute and his successors, who used England as the means to establish their hegemony in Scandinavia. We also dealt with Viking attacks in Ireland and its impact there. It destroyed that brilliant monastic culture of the early Middle Ages and in many ways dictated the future course of Irish history, because no Irish high king had sufficient resources and power to establish his hegemony despite the efforts of Brian Boruma, and Ireland was really condemned to political fragmentation until the arrival of the Normans in 1170, and that would that arrival of the Normans, that invitation that is extended to the Normans, their intervention in Ireland will open a whole new chapter with the English domination of Ireland and the changes thereafter. Scotland, too, is essentially a creation of the Viking Age. At the start of the Viking Age, no one knew what Scotland was going to be. Viking attacks across that strategic isthmus disrupted the Kingdom of Northumbria. The Vikings defeated the Strathclyde Britons, the Picts. It was the Scots, the most unlikely of candidates in Scotland, who had come to unite the northern third of Britain into the Kingdom of Scotland under Kenneth I. And that was because the Scots, Gaelic-speaking Irish immigrants, were able to survive the Viking raids and exploit the political disorder resulting from Viking raids to unite the various peoples, English, Britons, Picts, Scots, into a united kingdom in the late 10th century, just at about the time the Kingdom of England is being organized. Foremost, Russia. The development of the Russian principalities, however we want to call these areas, the future of what are now the modern states of the Ukraine, Belarus, and Great Russia, they owe their creation directly to the efforts of the Rus to develop market towns and trade with Constantinople. It was Vladimir, the Prince of Kiev, who converted to Orthodox Christianity and, in effect, brought Roman institutions from the Mediterranean world to the Russian forest zone and created, for the first time, a major political and cultural center in the Russian forest zone. And that civilization, which was sparked by the trading activities and the Viking activities of Scandinavians, led to the creation of Russia with profound consequences for European and world history. So across the whole of Europe, the Vikings had a major impact in determining the destinies, the political, the religious, and economic futures of both Western and Eastern Europe. There were profound changes in Scandinavia as well, and we should think upon some of the more positive contributions made by the Scandinavians. One is the skill in shipbuilding. And I spent considerable time discussing those achievements and the evolution of shipbuilding, which climaxed in the late 10th and 11th century with the great longships and canars, the ocean-going cargo vessels that allowed for the colonization of Iceland. the dragon ships, reputedly carrying 200 warriors, the most famous being the Long Serpent, the flagship of King Olaf Tryggvason of Norway. That's the ship from which he leaps into the sea at the Battle of Svold in 1000. These ships were on a whole other order than anything that had been seen in Northern Europe. And while the Scandinavians will lose their primacy in shipbuilding and trading to the Germans and the Dutch, starting in the 12th and then continuing in the 13th century, nonetheless, the Dutch and German shipbuilding, the superior ships of the later Middle Ages, were based directly on those Scandinavian shipbuilding traditions. And what the Scandinavians achieve in the early Middle Ages is a shipbuilding tradition in Northern Europe, which is parallel but different to the shipbuilding of Southern Europe, particularly centering in Italy, in the ports of southern France and of eastern Spain, Barcelona, Marseille, Genoa, and Venice. Europe had the unique situation in the Middle Ages of having two independent shipbuilding systems, one based on the ancient shell construction, the other on the skeleton construction of Northern Europe. And when those two traditions were swapped and influenced each other, presto, you had the development of the ocean-going vessels of the 15th and 16th century in Europe, once mounted with artillery that enabled Europeans to capture the globe. And so the Scandinavians had a major influence in the development of European shipbuilding and ultimately European domination worldwide. That northern shipbuilding is clearly one of the great technical achievements of the Viking Age. And there's really nothing like that before then. Above all, we've stressed in the changes of Scandinavia during the Viking Age that the Scandinavians adapted outside influences. Canute took the institutions of England and adapted them to creating an effective Danish state. Christianity triumphed in Scandinavia because it was accommodated to existing social and economic institutions. Best seen in Iceland, where Christianity is accepted in an almost classic Icelandic reconciliation between two warring parties in which the pagans were the majority and the Icelanders agreed to have the one faith, not to go to a religious war. And as a result of that conversion, the ancient traditions of the Northmen were preserved, that is the great sagas, the stories of the gods and the heroes of the past. We've seen how the Scandinavians were receptive also to all the technological advantages coming with the conversion to Christianity, how rapidly between 1100 and 1350 they took on superior techniques in agriculture. They modified their laws and institutions to create a Christian Scandinavia by 1350. And this is really quite an impressive achievement. As I mentioned in passing on several occasions, the three Scandinavian kingdoms today and the Republic of Iceland all can trace their political legacy back to the Viking Age. And that is no small achievement for an area that was long regarded on the fringe of Roman Europe and certainly later Christian Europe, and an area that never had had the benefit of Roman conquest and Roman institutions. So in the end, what was the overall Viking impact on medieval civilization? Well, maybe it can be summed up really in two big conclusions. First, their prowess in warfare. Their prowess as great seafarers. Despite all the suffering and destruction they wrought, they forced Christian Europe to organize and to arm itself. The Crusades, in some ways, are the logical result of the Viking Age. And to put it in a short sense, what did the Vikings give to Christian Europe? It gave them strength. It forced them to organize political and military institutions they may never have done otherwise. But in another area, too, they made an absolutely invaluable contribution. And that was done by the intrepid settlers in Iceland, just below the Arctic Circle. There, the Icelanders, because of the nature of their society and their conversion, recorded the ancient traditions of the Norse past, the gods, the heroes, the sagas, and the legends, and transmitted that literary heritage to later Western Europe. So that Norse component of the Viking Age, that literary achievement, that mythology, that genius of the Viking Age expressed in poetry was transmitted to later generations and became part of the greater legacy of Western Europe and took its place along with Roman Greek literature as well as the Christian and Jewish traditions that make up Western European civilization. So in the end, perhaps we should conclude that the greatest victories of the Vikings were not in England, not in Normandy, not in Russia, but on the Vellums, the manuscripts composed in Iceland.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teachone2.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-1-2. That's 1-800-TEACH-1-2. Thank you very much.